Why don't we come together?
Why don't we come together?
Why do we gotta fight?
Why do we gotta fight?
Let's be like sis and brother, who finally got it right. Let's face up each other, black, brown, yellow, blue, white. Let's cherish all the color instead of spitting spite.
Spitting spite.
The highest we can.
You are
be.
Listening to the Tom Fitton Show on WNHH LP 103.5 FM, your home for community radio.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Let's make it happen. And I was just thinking about the chance to see you again. I haven't seen you since you left our pristine New England waters and back yes. to your southern homeland.
But you know, I come up there though. Like, I'll be back up there in April.
Okay.
And I come up about once or twice a semester. Just want to let you know, I still make my way up there. It's just
excellent.
Short trips. Yes, sir.
Well, you know, it is for business or pleasure?
It's actually mostly business.
Okay.
When I'm up there, I'm either doing some work with, because I still work with the Yale School of Environment, with our Heartwood podcast that we were doing. And then I still connect with a few people in the city who actually have connections here in the state with my forestry background on some environmental justice stuff and some landowner stuff. So, yeah, so I still connect with people on the stuff I did when I was there.
Great. So, I mean, we were talking to Thomas Rashad Easley, and we both have the first last name. Our parents had good taste.
Yes.
So share with folks a little bit about your journey in terms of Alabama A&M, and then, you know, at Yale, and now what you're doing in terms of your diversity consulting. I guess I want to remind people for Black History Month that when I say Alabama A&M, people may have forgotten that, you know, agricultural and mining. So people, whatever you may think about Booker T and other folks, when they kind of started us on this path of really, I would say economic liberation, but agricultural and mining, I mean, that's where the gold is. That's where the platinum is. That's where the ore is. So we can look back at our history and understand that people try to point us in the right direction. It's up to us now not to get distracted and waylaid and exit strategies. Thomas, just before I jump in more detail and allow you to kind of share about your diversity, I want to just get rid of the elephant in the room. And I don't mean Donald Trump, but I do mean Gaza and the Middle East crisis. And I say that in the sense of, given your work, and I want you to kind of, you know, specify the new title of your diversity consulting. But it seems to me that folks, and I'm not trying to throw you a curveball, but it seems to me that even in just the general workplace as we speak right now, anywhere in the world, this issue of the Middle East, probably, you know, you're around your coffee or you're around your water cooler or just in a meeting, that this global tension kind of impacts, I think, how people perceive the world and even how they deal with others. And they may say something and slip, and then somebody else might make it to argument, might be a vociferous kind of thing over this tension that's going on. And so weave in if you can follow me, what I'm trying to say here in terms of your work, because the diversity, inclusion and equity work, whether you call it affirmative action or whatever you want to call it, or Rodney King, can we all just get along? This perpetual struggle is really fascinating. I just wonder whether you had any thoughts about just the general workplace right now, or what people, kind of advice you might want to or share with folks about, let's just get along and not get too distracted, share our views, and not let our ideological handprints kind of slap people in the face, either directly or indirectly.
You say ideological handprints, because I think that we all have them. I think every person, especially if you're in the workplace, you're going to have an opinion, you're going to have an idea, or you're going to have some type of an ideology. I think when we deal with these global tragedies or war or things going on around the world, unfortunately, there's still so much information, and then there's not enough specific information that say we can access ourselves unless we're there, you know, or unless we, you know, unless we're in the war, unless we know people who were there, unless we've been there ourselves, or we're there, like, you know, literally. And so that's why I love how you said that about the ideological handprint, because I do think that our society, in my opinion, is built a lot on secrets, And the things that people hold secret are the things that, in many ways, I think that lead and guide what it is that they do. This is what I mean. Like in the workplace, people don't talk about how much they make. But the money and why you're there, that the money is one of the main reasons why you're there. You see, like, the check that you're getting. People say we shouldn't talk about politics, but politics will affect where you do some of your social things, where you give your money, who you hang out with, right? So these things that are so pivotal to who we are, even church and state, we live in a society where things are secret. And my thing is, I like when you mentioned Rodney King, and you say, can we all get along? I think we can all get along if we can admit that we don't know it all. And I think that no one likes war. I don't think anyone likes war. I think that that's the one commonality that most people have. I don't think people should be subjected to war. I think we should try to find a way for peace. So then my thing is, okay, if we can at least hold that, then anything else is kind of up in the air because we don't know. And my thing is, since I don't know something, I'm not, what I don't know, I don't argue about. You see, and that's how I engage with people in the workplace. So I don't know. If someone says, what's your opinion? I'll admit I do have one, but then I'll determine whether or not I want to share it based on whether or not I know something. So when I'm working with people, I don't resist talking to them because I don't walk in with this full position that I think, oh yeah, this is what I do. I walk in and go, this is what I feel, this is what I'm thinking, but what do I know? And then that allows me to learn from other people. And then I also still say, I do think war is, I'm not going to say wrong because war is a part of what we do. Just like some people say conflict is wrong. No, it's not. Conflict is part of the way that we exist. That's how we figure things out. So I think that war, I don't like war. And I don't think that I hate that people are in war, but my hope is that that people would get out of this and that we would either find a way to support those who are the most horribly affected by this, and that we will also be supportive of those people in various ways, whether it's a listening ear, whether we can give funds, whether we can challenge our politicians, or whether we can be a safe haven for people.
Excellent. So let's segue in terms of some of your diversity work, and certainly over the next 40 or so minutes, I want to talk about your artistic commitment and passion and profession and business in that regard. And then your forestry work, whether it call it saving the whales or just saving ourselves. So, but let's let, but just elaborate a little bit more about in terms of your diversity consulting, because it seems to me that you sh share with people what you do in this regard and why they should even maybe try to look you up and see if they can economically commune with you.
Sure. Okay. Well, oh, just real quick, I want to ask, do you still want me to say anything about Alabama A&M, like my
Well,
background there?
yeah, sure. Okay, let's jump to your background, because it's so I find it really really fascinating with your you were you spent time in North Carolina, you're in North Carolina now and in Alabama, and so you're a
That's right.
global person, and obviously the cold spell up here at in Yaletown, some people call it New Haven. So yeah, we can jump back to some of your formative years in terms, even as you look back. I mean, I'll throw the question out. What were there one or two pivotal moments that you think caused you to consider Alabama A&M versus not? Was there a high school student or a high school teacher or a Sunday school teacher, or was there something that you can flash back in your memory that kind of spurred you on to kind of make that first step?
That is a great question, Mr. Fishman. Thank you for that. What it was I did not know that I was going to college, meaning that I didn't know how I was going to pay for it. I had no idea what I was going to major in before I went. Alabama A&M, Agricultural and Mechanical University, founded by William Hooper Council, 1875. I always say that, because they make sure that they drill that into us. They did a summer program that was sponsored by the USDA. And I was fortunate to get into that program. My high school counselor was very helpful with me doing that, at least, because we still didn't know what I was doing. We weren't sure. This is the end of my senior year, so no full college prospects, anything. And I went to the summer program. Fortunately, did really well. My project had to do with tree genetics. That's how I got involved in that's how I got interested in genetics, and that's what really ushered me in the forestry. And the Forest Service kind of judged our presentations that we made. They had some reps there, and I was one of the top three. And so I got the scholarship. And I've always been good at schools always come to me kind of not easy. It's something that I'm interested in: math, science, English, history, civics. So I started Alabama Agricultural and Mechanical University, and we are the Bulldogs. I grew up going to the Magic City Classic, Alabama State. The Hornets plays Alabama A&M, the Bulldogs. So one, I can do a quick one. You say something significant that happened. Yes, when I was an exchange student that went from Alabama A&M to the University of Georgia my junior year. University of Georgia also Bulldogs. And so that helped me to understand and grow up a lot more in my discipline of forestry. Because when I got to Georgia, what I felt like I saw at Georgia was a plethora of ways that forestry was taught. That's not to minimize at Alabama A&M, but one of the things I noticed at a lot of land grants, especially if they have support like by the government, that those programs, you kind of cultivate the people to go to the people who support you. Whereas when I went to UGA, which is a white university, historical white university, there were avenues to the government, but there were also avenues to private companies, to corporations, to starting your own business. You see, so when I went to UGA, I was like, oh, it was all these other ideas that I noticed that the students were learning. Whereas at A&M, I felt like we were more so kind of crafted to go work for the government. So that was one of my significant things. From Alabama A&M, I did graduate from A&M, not because I couldn't hack it at UGA. I did great at UGA, but I was there for my junior year. I went back to A&M, graduated. Fortunately, my scholarship was with the Forest Service, so I did seasonal work. And after college, I also did work in Montana, Bozeman, Montana, as well as Red Lodge, Montana. That's where, in my opinion, that's probably where my diversity work really took off in my mind, in my heart, because I had to figure out how to be the only Black person in the city, technically county, and engage with people when I was living in Montana, and I did. From there, I would stay, go to grad school. There was one guy from Alabama A&M who was already there, but when he graduated, I was the only African American in the department. So here again, I'm the only again, but I did well. Unfortunately, my committee members have passed on. They are ancestors now, but they really did invest in me, in particular Dr. Rick Hall, who was my major professor, and Dr. Sandy McNabb. And then from there, I started working in urban forestry. I didn't go to school for urban forestry, but I worked in urban forestry. I went to school for traditional forestry. I got my master's in genetics and forestry, but I'm working in urban. So now I'm getting this experience in grant writing, working with remote sensing, GIS, GPS, and also working with a nonprofit. See, I wasn't brought up to do that. So now I'm learning all of this. I finished there and then I end up at NC State. And then in my opinion, I would say at NC State is where like Forest Service was the first start of my career. NC State was the second. And so when I got to NC State, that's when my official diversity job happened. And I was the director of diversity in the College of Natural Resources at NC State. And I'll hush and just after this, just say
No,
all of
please.
those experiences from Alabama A&M and growing up in Birmingham and being a child of civil rights activists, my mother and my father.
Birmingham.
Birmingham, you said it right, of course, Birmingham. So that also plays a big part in my upbringing, right? And I'm a proud Black person. I'm proud, you know. I thank my family for that. Alabama A&M, Black school, the pride gets amplified, you know, because we know how to take care of each other at an HBCU. And then going to Iowa State, and UGA, I was able to show that the intelligence that my community gave me could hack it anywhere because it made it there. And then I do all this other work and get all this other experience that I didn't go to school for. A&M always told me, be prepared, you know, adjust, adapt, acclimate. And then I end up at NC State. And now I'm at NC State, a diversity director, because I'm a Forester and because I'm Black. And I'm here to help them bring in Black and Brown students like me and some not like me, just the same way that the Forest Service brought me in. And that's how I got into diversity work right there.
And then Yale called you as well.
Yes, okay. Glad you mentioned that. So then after 13 years at NC State, Yale reached out to me. Yale also are Bulldogs. So
That's right.
I'm just fascinated by how my career,
That's true.
my life, my calling has always been with the Bulldogs, but it started off with A&M. And that's why I always give A&M the props first. Even
That's
though
right.
Yale was founded in 1701, we were 1875. For me, it was full circle to end up at the first school of forestry in the world, technically, as an HBCU grad. And so I fortunately ended up working in the Yale School, now the School of the Environment, for 4 years. I'm under Dean Indy Burke, which I'm still in touch with. And it was a great experience. Now, at NC State, I was the diversity director in a college. When I got to Yale, I was the diversity dean in the school. So, you know, so it was a same structure, technically, with schools, if you will, different type of school, Ivy League versus land grant. And then a different position of director versus being a dean. Okay. And so, but the good thing is that being a dean, I got to learn a lot about upper administration. I got to learn what it means to have a big budget now and talk to people with big budgets. I was in rooms with people that were trying to get them to give money. So I got to see this whole other side of academia and still was a professor, still taught, still did my typical, I would say, administrative things while I'm working with students, faculty, and staff, making sure that things operate smoothly in the school. And the thing that I can say about when I was there at Yale is like people like you in the community, you know, and you and I were in touch, you know, like the whole time that I was there. I was fortunate. One, like I said, I'm a proud Black person, right? So I'm interacting with a number of beautiful Black people in New Haven. You know, like when I got there, my ignorance was, I'm not sure people actually know how Black this city is. But what I do know is that, no, many people do know how Black this city is and how amazing that it is and how powerful it is. If I didn't have the connections in the city, and my cousin is there too, and my sister
Oh,
lived in
tremendous,
Hartford, you see, so
tremendous.
if I didn't have the family, if I didn't have the community, Mr. Ficklin, I do think that it probably would have been a different existence for me at Yale. You know, I mean, Yale is a great place, but the people in the community and the city are even more beautiful. And when you know who you are and you're proud of who you are, when you're in a place that's always on edge and kind of could challenge you, it's good to know that you have, like I said, people like you, my cousin Patrick Mitchell, you know, and other people in the community that I could go to and not just go to for I need help. I could go to for ideas on what I need to do, and I could go to for instruction on where I need to go. So that's the other thing. It wasn't like
Excellent.
using the community, it was being instructed by the community too.
Excellent. And before we go to I mean, you wear several professional hats, but your diversity consulting work and your that in terms of your purpose and passion and product, weave in, if you would, in terms of the story, and I'm glad you kind of provided your origin story in a way. Weave in your the words that come to me is your religious re revelation, but that journey when you, that journey that I think has been somewhat parallel to your so-called I want to say so-called your professional life. Where did the church, the church commitment, the religious commitment, the ministerial commitment kind of was it parallel? Was it
It was.
integrated with everything that you're talking about, or was it kind of a those various ingredients? How do we have we have a I have a Creole in front of me, so I have a professional Creole in front of me, excuse the expression, so I'm just a gumbo in front of me.
Oh man, listen, that, you know, I'm trying, no, I'm not gonna do, because you know, people I say, thank you for the, I'm not gonna do that, no. But it's so hard not to, because I've never been asked that. No one has ever asked me that in the interview about my spiritual or my religious background and how that. So my religious background really guided me the whole time. I love your question. So this is in the challenge of your question. The religious and spiritual aspect of me is the most important part. It doesn't run, it can't run parallel, because it informs everything else. So for me, if I didn't have that, if I didn't have that, I wouldn't have been able to reach out to people in the New Haven community to help me. I wouldn't have been able to connect with people in Raleigh, North Carolina, to connect with me, because I would be being so insecure, I wouldn't want to reach out. I want to remain small and shrink. So my relationship with my creator, you know, it has evolved over time. I grew up in the church, but I also, when my grandmother died when I was in high school, I converted to Islam, joined the Nation of Islam before becoming a Sunni Orthodox Muslim. And so so just like I have professional hats, I've had many religious hats that I've worn over time. And I'm thankful for that, because it's informed me how to work with people and how to talk to people, and it's helped me to value people as just beautiful beings more so than just tearing them down, even people who don't look like me. And so my religious as background is what helped me, it sustained me in my work in this diversity work. Because what my religious background and my spiritual background shows me, tells me, is this. I'll keep it simple, because I don't want to proselytize the people here. But my spiritual background tells me that we all come from the same source. Okay, we all, you know, because it's ashes to ashes, dust to dust. We shall return. That also, but it also tells me that we all have amazing things going on inside of us, whether we acknowledge it or not. Things going on in the universe are also going on inside of us. Things happening in nature are happening inside of us. So the God that other people worship, I've learned that you need to turn in, because that God is inside of you. And if you don't know how to tap into that power, you're always going to feel insecure, because you don't think that you're worthy. or you don't think that you've done anything, and that's and then and that's the that's being too humble. And then you have the ego people who think that they've done everything, right? And that they can do it on their own. And the truth is, neither one of those is true. What's true is that we all need help. We all want to be valued, respected, and heard. And that's because I think we all have the same origin. So if I look at a macro or spiritual lens, in my opinion, we're all the same. It doesn't matter if you're autistic, it doesn't matter if you're gay, it doesn't matter if you're black, doesn't matter if you're white, if you're a man, if you're a woman, you're a child, if you're an elder, if you're a twin, a triplet, if you are an orphan, if you are rich, wealthy, it doesn't matter, like, because we all come from the same source, we're the same. So that's the reason why I never get intimidated. But I say this, and I'm also never impressed with people. So I don't get intimidated, like, oh my God, there's Jay-Z. But I'm also not impressed. Oh my goodness, that's Beyoncé. It's not because it's not an ego thing. It's like Martin Luther King was an ordinary person, according to my uncle, who worked with Dr. King and who was there when King died. But he did extraordinary things. So that means we all of that. So when I got to Yale, right, whereas there's a lot of brilliant people there, but see, I got there and what I did was say, I'm brilliant too. When I was at NC State, right, there were a lot of people. I didn't go in there thinking that at first. I'm like, I'm not brilliant. I don't know that I belong. So when I was at State, I met a lot of people who chat, who questioned their own worth. When I was at Yale, I met people who did that, but the majority of people didn't do that. The majority of people knew that they were great. So then I was like I said, ego too low. Neither one of them are right. It's the middle part. Yeah, I'm great, but I'm great because of what others have given me. So that means others are great too, and that means that I can create more. And that's how the religious aspects also informs my diversity work. Because my diversity work is, like I said, everyone needs to be respected, valued, and heard. And as a matter of fact, I can answer your first question that you started with the practice. That's the work that we do in My Heart for Diversity. We do the work that we have done already, and then we're open to new work. Meaning, I don't rest in theory in the work that we do in my firm. I rest in what we've done before. When someone calls us, they want to, I always say, are you serious? They go, why are you serious? Because you're talking to someone who's actually successfully done diversity work. Then sometimes they don't know what that means either. They go, well, what is that? I said, that means that I've changed with a team how an organization looked, meaning I brought in difference in the white organization and brought in the people of color and put them in significant organ in significant positions. Then they go, okay, but that's just one part of it. Because you can bring people in and they can look like you and me, but don't think like you and I. That's dangerous. Because then they're going to keep you and me out. I don't do that. Then I also don't do this. I don't look for people who don't look like you and me, but I go, oh yeah, they think like you and I, especially if I don't think that they're real and they're faking. No, I work with people who come in, I work with them, find out what they can do, help to put them in a place where they'll be the most efficient and the most effective. And then the other thing we did at Yale and the NC State is then we changed how it operated. So not only did we bring people in, but remember I said put them in significant positions. When I was at NC State, the first hire I had was of a full professor, the first full professor that we had in the school. His name was Myron Floyd. He is now the dean of the College of Natural Resources at NC State. That's what I tell people when I say change how it operated, not just how it looked, but how it operated. Because Myron does not have the same ideas. He has, oh, excuse me. Myron doesn't have all the same ideas that his white predecessors have. He has some. Then Myron has his own. At Yale, I was the assistant dean. Okay. When I left, there was an associate dean. Okay. And when I was there, it was me by myself by almost the first year. Then brought in my sister, Yolanda Quinones from the Bronx, New York. That's my sister forever. But when I left, it was an associate dean with another dean under her and another person. So you see, right? So you see, that's the thing, right? I look at what I do and go, wow, if people are impressed by what I do, I'm like, great. But then people come behind me and can do even greater. Just like people who came before me did great. So I make sure that I pay homage to them. And to me, that's how diversity works. Don't disrespect the people who came before you, but you can challenge it if they've done some things off, because nothing is perfect. And leave the door open for those coming behind you so that they can pick up the mantle and carry effect further than you. So.
And for folks to name drop in terms of the your contact information, in terms of your consulting firm, how folks can kind of, the purpose of us chatting is kind of give a 35-minute, 45-minute tease of folks to kind of recognize that the resource that you bring not only just to the South but to the world.
Yes,
So
sir.
your best contact information for the for your firm.
MindHeartForDiversity.com is the website. From there, you can also reach me. You can email me at treasley@mindheartfordiversity.com. I'll go ahead and give you our number too, 919-521-8506. Yes, we have our own number. And then you can find me on Instagram, Dr.ThomasRashad Easley. And you can find me on Facebook, the same under Mind Heart for Diversity. And then also you can find our YouTube channel, Mind Heart for Diversity, where we actually put up videos that you can use and download and share with colleagues that talks about our work. We have a video series, one called For Those Who Resist DEI, because we know that people don't like DEI, and we want to, and but we also think we understand some of why they don't. Remember, we talk about what we've done. We have another series about how to make a welcoming workplace. It's a 10-part series, so that you can get that. And then we also have, and those are series, so it's like series, like 1 to 7 videos, you know, more videos. And then we just have some where we just give you actual input, like if you want to unpack something, this is what you do. You know, if you want to deal with, you know, e equity versus equality, which one should you do? So we also have videos there, so you can find us on YouTube as well.
I do want to take a further deep dive in terms of your consulting practice at the moment. But I want you to kind of just also weave in, you've referenced, and I'm really pleased with your transparency in terms of your religious journey, your spiritual journey, and the very and the, I'll say the ecclesiastical journey that you've got that you've been on, as well as your academic journey. But weave in what this is the I guess now the 51st year, the celebration of the, if you will, the origin of hip hop. Weave in where that kind of that thread also kind of entered your persona, and share a little bit about, because you have your, I think you've had several productions in the last 2 or 3 years. So weave that in. Not to say that you're the only Renaissance man on the planet, but I was so glad to kind of chat with you, because I know you could illustrate to people listening that we have gifts. We have gifts.
Well, hey, you know, in the Christian stance, they say God gave us gifts, and if you don't use those gifts, God will take them away. And so, I do think that, and talents and gifts sometimes are different, but for some people, they're interchangeable. They're the same thing. We are entering, and this is, and I just want to add just some more layers to it. Yeah, we're entering the 51st year of recorded hip hop music. You know, and I have a label that's called Easley, that's entitled Easley Branch. Of course, it's named after me. We have artists, producers, musicians, and we also work with nonprofits and other churches in particular to create musical content. And you can find us on the Easley Branch YouTube page, also easleybranch.com. We have a website too, so you can go there and find our materials and find the artists who I and now others work with. The really powerful thing about the talent and the gift is I think that when people have typical 9 to 5s, or children who go to school, you know, from 8 to 4, 8 to 3, 8 to 5. You know, it's really interesting how jobs, schools, and prisons have something in common, that you're not in control of your own time. So you do what somebody else tells you to do. When you live a life like that, the artist inside of you, the creative inside of you, either wants to fight against it, or it gets to a point where it is kind of socialized out of you. And so we at the Easley Branch believe in maintaining the artistic creative aspect, because to me, that's the thing that keeps us in the middle of the road. Because I can get my anger out in my art, I can get my depression out of my art, I can get my sadness out of my art, I can get my excitement out of my art, and I can take the different things that I learn, whether it's from a great conversation like this with you, or whether it's from an irritating conversation with someone that I didn't want to talk to, and I can unpack it through poem and then turn that over into song. And so that is what we do at the Easley Branch, which is why the majority of our content is all clean. We don't really curse in our music. We don't demean and disrespect people. We don't use the B word in regard to women. We don't use the N word in regard to Black people. You know, we just don't do that. So the same way we don't do that to ourselves, we also don't do that to other people. We also don't let people come into our camp and bring that kind of energy. We've had some of that's happened. One thing we're not is nonviolent in my label, but we are peaceful. Don't cross us the wrong way, because we ain't Dr. King. But Dr. King cared, and we do too. So we let people know that. And I'm not saying that to brag and that like we're tough. I'm saying that some people think that just because you're a nerd that you won't protect yourself. We're nerdy on our label. You know, we believe in talking about intelligence stuff. We're like where Native Tongue left off, where Kanye West, the college dropout, and after that, I ain't talking about nothing else with regard to him. We pick up with that regard. We're all about intelligence, peace, and positivity, but we're also like Wu-Tang. We also come from areas where we had to defend ourselves. And when you're a person of color and you do move through the ranks, it's that's a normal, like you said, I'm not the only Renaissance man. How many people of color have had to survive in their home environments, let alone in a professional environment? You know, one environment I'm dodging my life. Let's say that's home, that's the hood, that's where I grew up. One environment I feel like I'm trying to find my peace. If I don't feel my peace, I want the pain to end, and then that's taking my life. That's a professional setting. And so that's where the spiritual aspect still comes to me, that this gift that was given to me by the Most High, I have to use it to give the Most High glory. And the number one way of doing that is to connect with other people. And we do that in the label, and we support people. I shouldn't say allow, because we're not slave masters, but we support people expressing themselves how they want to. So, and I'm a trombonist first. I tell people that I am a hip hop artist myself, but I play the trombone. I am a record producer. I do know how to program music as well as play and write music. And then I'm a hip hop artist. I can still break dance. I'm 45. I'm still in the shape of a 25-year-old. And so when we perform, we give you a full show: DJ, dance, and music, hip hop, rhymes, bars, and all.
And again, if folks are interested in that aspect of it, the artistic aspect, what's the best place for them? Just reference again your YouTube and other places where they can find out and perhaps even engage you in some performances.
Yes, sir. Easleybranch.com, EASLEY, branch.com. And that's the website. YouTube, just find Easily Branch on YouTube. That's the channel. If you want to reach out to me on the music side of things, find us on Instagram under Easily Branch Music. Notice with the diversity is Dr. Thomas Richard Easley. But with the music, you find me at Easily Branch Music. Facebook, you can find me at Richard Ease, because that's the moniker that I go under. It's basically my middle name and half of my last name. I'm going out like Tupac, I guess. And I mean, using my name, I ain't going out like Pop. But RIP to him, like forever. And then our email is info@easilybranch.com if you want to find us.
Excellent. Let's, if it's okay with you, let's spend it now maybe 10 or so minutes, 15 minutes on this DEI industry, whatever term or category you think or definition pertains. My mind goes back to affirmative action, as I mentioned, Rodney King, the Bible, the Ten Commandments, the Book of Thomas. This issue, it seems to me, whether we are engaging in this dystopian precipice of the end of the world, which is not just, I don't think, a hyperbole in terms of the potential to eliminate us. But everyone I talked recently, and it could be just a matter of my cohort of folks that I interact with, although I do interact with a lot of different people, ages, and there seems to be a universal global concern about where this planet is heading, as you say, not only from an ecological standpoint, political standpoint, religious standpoint, society standpoint. So I'm trying to weave in your clear commitment on your journey on the planet thus far, and where this world, and you referenced MLK several times, Junior, where do we go? Where do we go from here? It seems to me that you're devoting so much of your life to this, and to getting some collective answers and or collective solutions to where do we go from here? Where can we go from here? Where may we go from here?
Mr. Strickland, the reason why I'm smiling, laughing, and I never take light when I'm speaking to a leader like yourself. I'm smiling because you just asked me the title. You mentioned King's, the title of his last book. So when you said, "Where do we go from here?" I was like, "Well, that was his book, and that's what he." And I feel like his book has solutions in it, which is another one of the reasons why he was taken out. So I just want to say that I actually think an answer to what you just asked me is that text, is Martin Luther King's book. Okay. For a couple of reasons. One, he dealt with in that book how, because the same issues he talked about then in the 60s when he wrote that book, we're still dealing with now in 2023, 60 plus 6 decades later. He dealt with the fear of love in that book, I feel, because the fear of love is the root of all of the indiscretions and injustices that we're dealing with, from racism to sexism. And he talked about how we, that he gave ways that we can listen to each other, hear each other, and really make space for each other. To me, that's the human side. Which is what my spiritual practice teaches me that I need to do. That's the reason why I stay humble. I know that there are things that I know, but what I also know is that, Like I remember when I met you when I first came to New Haven. When you started breaking the history down, like when I came there, because you connected me to the mayor at the time, and did that. I'm like, I didn't know all that was going on here. If I would have come in there like I knew everything, I couldn't have taken the advice you gave me and the intelligence and used it, you see? So that's why I stay humble, so that I can always grow and so that I can always be available. That's the human and that's the spiritual side. The ecological side is, for me, it's a little bit more complex because the planet is an ecosystem. But we talk about the planet like it's different ecosystems. What I do here affects those in Antarctica. What my cousin does in California affects those in China. Someone does in Africa, and we know that to be true because Africa is the one continent everybody wants to take from. And it's the one continent where the first sign of life ever came from. And it's the one continent that certain people of different hues try to get away from. It's the strangest thing, but that's another interview, so I know. And so when I look at ecologically, I think the way that we treat each other humanly is where we treat this planet ecologically. That's why we got to get the human part right first. Because if we can't listen to each other and hear each other, then we're going to keep doing what we've been doing, misdiagnose that landscape, not knowing what needs to be planted there, not knowing what needs to go there, and just do what I do. And so basically, this is what a lot of we do in forestry. We cut down trees and then we'll replant, right? Well, the bad part is I mean, so okay, the good part is we replant, right? Well, the bad part is what do we replant and how do we replant it? Do we replant it the way it was before it was left? It's impossible. You can't do it. We're not that smart. We're not God. See, we don't design landscapes well. Nature already did that for us. So then when we go back and plant, we plant so that we can go back and harvest again. So, and we also plant what we want to go back and harvest again. Well, unfortunately, if that what we plant is not native to that place, that soil cannot get back stabilized the way that it was. You see, because it can't wrap because the root system cannot do what it needs to do in that soil, and the soil can't do what it needs to do for those roots. Trees are the reason why flooding can be cured, because the roots will suck up the water. The lack of trees being somewhere is why flooding always happens, because there's nothing to take up the water. Okay, so ecologically, if we're not listening to the earth, we're going to continue to abuse the earth. Just like if we don't listen to each other, we're going to hurt each other. Now, let me just kind of make this very simple, and then hopefully I ask you if I've answered your question. Here in Raleigh, I can count more than five, what some would call micro forests, that have been cut down in less than 6 months. Now, this is what a micro forest is. See, what most people think is a big forest is like Western North Carolina, Asheville's, Covenant Mountains, number trees. That's what most people think a forest is. But a forest is also what New York City used to look like before it was overdeveloped. See, trees were there too in that part of the state. How do you know? Because trees are in every other part of the state of New York. But what do we talk about? We talk about New York City, which is the dirtiest and most contaminated part of the state. But that's the place that everybody knows. No one knows. Not that's that corrected. Not a lot of people can talk about Lake Placid. A lot of people have been there. The reason why I say those five micro forests, I'm talking about an acre less to like 5 acres large. Mr. Ficklin, we're cutting those down everywhere. So when you look at an urban environment, as we say, urban versus rural or even suburban, which urban and really suburban are the same. When you look at an urban environment and then we talk about green space, well, we don't have any, and we don't have as much as we need, and it's so developed that there's no understory. So what I'm saying is that if we don't find a way to value chaos in nature, because what's happening is we're trying to reorder it, and nature doesn't need our help. If we don't learn how to value a storm when it comes, because see, right now what happens is a storm comes, we go and we protect, but that storm is doing something that the planet actually needs. If we don't know how to value wildfire and keep fuel at a low from our mishaps, but use fire in the way that it needs to be, like the indigenous folks of this land who are also related to you and I actually did, we're not going to save the planet. But the planet will save itself. As the planet has always done. We believe that dinosaurs walked this planet at one time, right? I'm gonna speak colloquially. Where they at? So that tells you something. This planet will do what it needs to do for itself. We know about African dynasty that are over 10,000 years old. We know Imhotep was here more than 20,000 years ago. The planet will do what it needs to protect itself. So humans, everybody who's listening, we need to learn to embrace each other and learn to respect this land more, because whether you own land or not, you're probably harming the land, whether you know it or not. If you're not even respecting or praying over your water before you do it, you're not respecting the resources that the Creator has given us. So none of us are guiltless. All of us are guilty, but some of us are more guilty than others because we don't own land. And we don't, you see what I'm saying? We don't control that. It's just like talking to a drug dealer who doesn't bring drugs into the country. We'll put the drug guy or woman in jail, but we're not where they get it from. So basically, we need to be more concerned about the sources of these problems. We need to be more concerned about our contribution to these problems. And then we need to be more solution-minded and not always finger-pointed, because at this point, that's not going to solve anything. We got to figure out how to fix these issues. And the number one way, I believe, is to listen to each other and be willing to give up of your own so that someone else can benefit. Because the less we have, but the more enriched we are, the better this planet will be. That's my
Weave in if
take.
you weave in if you would, Thomas, and I'm not trying to ask you to be repetitive, but when I throw out the word environmental racism to you, just chat about that a little bit, and also maybe give a shout out, given this 24/7 365, whether it's Black Negro History Week or Black History Month or African Genesis Year, Robert B Bullard, the economist, yeah. Wait,
EJ.
talk about environmental racism, and then give us some shout outs to our Moses, our Black Moses, in this regard, in terms of saving the planet, in terms of Mr. Bullard.
Yeah, okay. Well, first, one word to explain environmental racism to me: redlining. I'll use that first. And that's just dealing with housing, because that's not really dealing with the other parts of the environment. Redlining is a practice that's still practiced to this day, and it's an issue that has plagued our country for a long time. I can't talk about redlining without talking about the GI Bill. If you're a veteran listening to this, this is not me trying to attack you, but if you want to know about the real inequities, a lot of people use the military as a great source of equity because of how they break people down and build them back up. I use the military also as a source of inequity when you look at the history of the GI Bill and how Black soldiers and military men in particular, because it wasn't as many women after World War II. When they came back, they didn't get the GI Bill, but others did. And because they got the GI Bill, they were able to buy houses that we couldn't buy, go to school that we couldn't attend, start businesses that we couldn't develop. So right there, environmental racism, that to me, that's one of the roots of it right there. So if you can't buy a house, then I can tell you where you can live. If you can't get a loan, I can tell you where I can tell you where you need to go. And if you can't get into school, you got to take the job that I give you, which led to why the civil rights movement was so important. It still is. The Affirmative Action Act is so important. It still is. And the Voting Rights Act is important, and it still is. Women's rights is important, and it still is. Even LGBTQ plus rights. Okay, now, environmental racism then shows itself by people who, basically Black and brown people, but poor people, period. Because this is really a class issue, not just a racial issue. If you can't afford to be somewhere, then we can make sure that you don't move in here. And redlining was very successful with that. And that is why when you look at environmental injustices in the communities that are, some would say, inequitably exposed to these injustices. Now, what, like, give me an example. Flooding in communities. Black people live in communities where flooding a lot of times happen when there's bad rain. And that is because of environmental racism and redlining that placed people in those communities. And then they didn't get the resources that they needed. So even when flooding came out, you can go to parts of Southeast Raleigh and see where lots are, where houses were. And they're not here anymore. Racism. But if you go to parts of Cary, you don't see that happening in Cary. And Cary is just the other side of Raleigh. Southeast Raleigh, Garner, Clayton, poor side. Cary, Mooresville, heading to Chapel Hill into the Triangle, rich side. People on this side of Southeast Raleigh, temperature is 8 to 10 degrees hotter than in Cary. So that's environmental racism. That's a, and that's how environmental racism, that's a sign of how it shows up. I want to just bring it back to Dr. Bullard, okay?
Please.
Who is the godfather, known of the godfather or grandfather of the environmental justice movement, which was founded in 1982, but the issues that led to environmental justice were going on decades, centuries before then. Okay. And that movement actually was cemented in Warren County, North Carolina. Okay. And in 1982, when the Transformer Company took soils from this city, and they've relocated and took it to Warren County and put them there. And over the next 20 plus years after they did that, people got sick. The water was contaminated. When I say sick, there were PCBs in the soil that leached into the water. People started developing cancer, among other sicknesses. Environmental racism, how does it show itself? Well, here's how. The majority of people who live in that county are all black and brown. And it was a Democratic governor that okayed the transformer company being able to do that. So this is why, this is it is about politics, but it ain't about a party being better than the other one. You see, because bad stuff happens, period. You know what I'm saying? When you don't consider the community that's going to suffer. And that was the problem. And that's why the environmental justice movement was so powerful with its five tenets of it. And one of it is how to redistribute that pain, that we're going to try to prevent victims from the beginning. That's what it means to have a justice lens and, as part of your work. And I think that that's what a lot of these industries are starting to do now. And I thank leaders like Dr. Buller for holding his foot down and still fighting this fight, because he's still in it. It's not
Absolutely.
over. It
That's right.
has not been solved, because people are still doing what I said. They're doing the opposite of what I said. We still want to do what we want to do. This planet is not going to allow for that. Okay. We can have a spirit of abundance, but we got to have a mindset of how to be of how to sustain and how to utilize our resources. And so we have people who have been exposed to pollution, to chemicals, to all kinds of stuff because of poor economics. And that's not their fault, okay? That's the, like that has to do with society. Remember, like I said, redlining and so many other things that were put into place before we got here. So I thank Dr. Bullard. I thank the environmental justice movement, which to me is an extension of the civil rights movement, which is an extension of all human rights movement. And environmental racism is still among us and is still with us. And we really need to do away with it. And we need to do a better job besides just saying a land acknowledgement and just acknowledging that people are dealing with this stuff.
Excellent. When you see and read the news, and just even over the last few days of the problem in LA with the storms, what kind of comes to your mind?
Well, what comes to my mind with that? And the rain just stopped. I got to go to California in the next 2 days, actually. So I have to be out there myself, for a sad reason, for a family funeral. But still, I have to be there. It makes me think about, well, you remember how I mentioned the storms and how we try to prepare for the storms, but we try to prepare for the storms by protecting what we already have. I think that a few hundred years ago, I don't know that they would have been like preparing for the storm to just protect what they have. I think that people would have been preparing for the storm by getting ready for what it's going to look like after the storm. You see, because they understood that there's nothing that said the truth is, Mr. Ficklin, nothing separates us from outside. We're actually outside even in our homes. Because let a storm come and blow it over. And where you at? You back outdoors, right? And so I think that there are people who came before us who actually understood that. And so that storm in California makes me think about environmental injustice when I think about the way that neighborhoods were created, the way that cities have been planned, and how when you don't, like when you overdevelop, remove understory, remove topsoil, and just keep planting, I mean, and just keep building and building and building, when the storm comes through, there's nothing to take up the water. You know what I'm saying? There's nothing to take it up. So it makes me think about the poor ways that we've managed ourselves and our society and civilization up until this part. Let me tell you something else. It also makes me think about something else, because the storms, I think, primarily hit Southern California. I think the water, I know throughout Cal,
LA.
but mostly LA, right? Okay. But see, if you go back to the 70s and we go to Northern California, when they planted eucalyptus trees and replaced the redwood trees with eucalyptus trees. There was a windstorm that came through. This was in the 70s, and it ended up destroying 5,000 homes because the eucalyptus trees exploded, caught on fire, and destroyed these homes. Go back to what I said about forestry. You can cut down and replant, but what do you plant? And how do you plant it? And so we get in our own way by just trying to do what we want. And I feel like the fact that we've been doing that's the reason why these storms have such a, have such a monumental effect on us, when
Excellent.
they hit, because of the lifestyles that we continue to lead. And so that's not me trying to demean anyone in LA. Hey, please, I hope those who are alive are safe and I hope that you didn't lose too much. That's not me trying to attack you all, but I am addressing that the reason why we struggle in these storms is because of the privilege and the disadvantage and the advantages that we have in the way that we live now as a society. And that's my opinion. Some can challenge that, but that's my opinion.
Thomas, let's take, we have about 10 more minutes. Let's let people again know the various ways that they can contact you in terms of the various things that you offer.
Okay. All right. If you're interested in talking about, and let me put some more language to it, because we don't just do diversity work. If you care about leadership development, organizational development, mentorship, evolving, recruiting, not burning out, how to do strategic planning, okay, how to create curricula, how to implement curriculum, how to facilitate, how to do this type of organizational growth work and be able to do it once a consultant goes. That's why you call Mind Heart for Diversity. We prepare you to do it once we leave. That's why I wrote a book and entitled it Mind Heart for Diversity. I point to it, Mind Heart for Diversity. That's why I published a book called that, because I believe that when it comes to this DEI stuff, people can do a lot of it on their own. The genius is inside of us. You can find us at mindheartfordiversity.com. You can find us on Instagram, Dr. Thomas Richard Easley. You can find us on YouTube, mindheartfordiversity.com. The other thing is in finding our diversity work. Our diversity work transcends into our production music work, which you can find more of that at easilybranch.com. The reason why I did that is because remember I said I'm still connected to Yale. We have a podcast that's entitled Heartwood, HEARTWOOD, but we've run that mostly through Easily Branch. Okay, but you can access that podcast anywhere you get, different episodes, so on and so forth. You can find us there. Then from there, you can find me on easilybranch.com, and you can find me at Rashadies on Facebook or Easily Branch Music. And remember, our artwork is about creating music that is about revolutionary thinking. We are not trying to demean people. We're not against cursing. We just don't, like most of us on the label, we don't, but we work with people who do. But we want people to know that we do respect the cultures and experiences of everybody else, but we also push minds forward by really kind of, it's like being a comedian in music and in entertainment. Notice comedians see things that everybody else don't see. We just don't make fun of it, but we do try to pull out what you don't see.
Let me push for the last 5 minutes or so, if you don't mind. Allow me to push you a little further now that you're still a young man. I'm glad you shared your chronological age.
Thank you.
But God willing, spirit willing, you'll be around for a few more decades. I'm just curious, is there anything else on your plate, or are you just looking to kind of maximize or scale up things you're already doing? I'm just curious, with so much that you've accomplished thus far, what's kind of, when you wake up, do you still have fantasies or dreams or visions or something that's still in your quiver that you
Yes.
still want to unleash and reveal and share?
Oh yes. Oh yes. One, as a person who used to weigh 300 pounds and who now weighs 165, naturally, and who is a plant-based eater, I wake up every morning happy to be alive, and I wake up every morning going outside barefoot, walking on the grass. I take cold showers in the morning. I'm more excited about my physical fitness and what I can do with my body than I am anything. Because at least right now, with me having all my abilities and faculties, there's the one thing that I can control, which is me. And so that is what excites me. I can do a full split again. It excites me that I can break dance still. It excites me that I can rock climb and do 20 pull-ups in a set, that I can jump rope and still work out with Marines and Army and Navy. That's what excites me, and that's what keeps me going. And that also is what keeps me encouraged, because I look at it like this, Mr. Fishman. If I can change, anyone can change. And I don't mean it because I think that I'm just that good or that so horrible. What I'm saying is that there's nothing about me that makes me so special and better than anybody else. So if I can change and change my life, then they can too. And then with that helps me to be more creative. Working on book number two, Mind Heart Strategies. That's the name of book number two. We're probably going to convert the name of the business soon to Mind Heart Group, so that people don't just isolate us in diversity. Okay. So I'm working on that. We're working on an environmental album that's going to be coming out soon called The Branch. Where we're working with kids and here in the in youth, excuse me, youth leaders here in the state to put the album together. And we're and now going to be connecting with youth in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You know, we did some work with the environmental school there for the last couple of years with their high schoolers, helping them. So I'm excited about the art that we are creating. My heart for diversity, we are scaling up because now we're working on automated materials because we're traveling. Now that everybody's outside, as we say, we're traveling everywhere. Our clients are bringing us to them. So there's some things that we need people to be able to access when you can't get to us. So we have automation stuff coming and bringing in a couple of other facilitators to do this work. Because, like I said, we don't just do diversity; we do organizational development. We even work with churches and help them with their, you know, like spiritual development and how to apply things or spiritual organizations. Because DEI to me are principles. Just like I believe, I'll say it like this further, and then I'll stop. I believe that the God that I don't, I can't say I serve because I don't believe you can serve something that owns everything. It's impossible. So I'm going to say the God that I believe is over me. I pray to God and my ancestors to inform me about what I should do every day, and then they guide me in the way that I should connect with other people. They even guide me to when I should eat. I don't even eat throughout the day anymore. I have days where I don't eat, you know. And so I'm also excited to be more in tune with the planet. And I think that that's the other thing that we need to do as people. That's a very macro thing. I know it's another interview to explain that because other people are like, how do we do that? I will be glad to tell them that.
Well, and I'll be glad to have you, as you say, this certainly from my standpoint, this is not a one-off, so I'm looking forward to us chatting again, and
Yes, sir.
I'll be more specific once the Pittsburgh situation evolves and kind of manifests itself. I was born in Pittsburgh, so love to chat with you about what's cooking there and your involvement.
Okay.
And then lastly, I'm since you last seen me in person, I'm
Yes, sir.
now an elected official in the New Haven area. So I'm on the,
We're
our what we
following you.
our city council, but so I represent something called Ward 28, but that Ward 28 has more trees than any other ward in the city. It's yeah, Ward 28. So I'll send you some information. And so our lady for the city that kind of manages our trees, I'll have her on this show soon, because this area of Ward 28 had been perceived to be kind of an exclusive community, a gated community. And
Okay.
but yeah, we have more elms. That New Haven is some people equate with not only pizza, but we call ourselves the Elm City.
Elm
But
City.
yeah, but we have more elms in my ward. So I'm a custodian, and I love to chat with you about that and kind of connect with have our city person connect with you in that regard. Let me give you the last word, and just whatever kind of like to share as the spirit moves you, because it's really, really important for people to kind of know you, know what you're about, and to kind of just be. And just to really embrace this content communion.
Well, communion, the root word of it is going to be to commune. And to commune is for, I think, is for us to come together and for us to share of what we have. And I think if we can, to celebrate. And if we can't celebrate, to be sad together. And I think that that's the thing. Or if one is celebrating and one is sad, that we're still together because we're communing. We don't control one another's emotions. We control ourselves. And I do think that communion is what we need as humans. And then I'm glad you said that because you just gave me more ways of saying what I said earlier. And then we need to commune with the planet because I actually believe that the planet, like in religious circles, they'll say God never stops talking. In nature circles, they say nature never stops working. Well, isn't it funny? We say nature and God doesn't sleep because they're always working. So then that means that maybe some of us, like me, I talk a lot, okay? I need to
You've been
hush
accused of that.
and listen.
I find that
No,
remarkable.
actually, I haven't been accused of it, but I always accuse myself. Sadly, I've actually been accused of not, because when I'm in public, I actually don't like to talk. Because I'm very shy. I don't even like sometimes people to talk to me in public. It's not because I'm antisocial. I'm just like, I don't think I have much to give sometimes. But I do know that I talk a lot. And I'm one of those people who needs to be quiet and listen when I'm outdoors and when I'm indoors. So everybody, that's also another way of communing. And then that's what some people call a meditation, a praying. But I do believe that communing is also about being silent internal within.
Excellent. Thomas, thank you so much. I'll throw out a little teaser, perhaps as a stimulus for not only our second show, but maybe our third and our fourth over the next year, in
Yes, sir.
terms of your perspective on plant-based medicines. As you know, psilocybin, LSD, magic mushrooms, peyote, all that is kind of resurrecting itself in terms of what nature has been providing. And I'd love to get your
Yes.
take. You're taking on that, perhaps for our next show. I'll send you some information, some background information, and then
Please, because I
the
have
ESP.
opinions on that and facts.
My ESP tells me that you would, and I've done two or three shows in this regard because nature is talking to us, as you reference, in so many ways, and I think it's an opportunity for us to listen. So I really want to thank you for your time, and we'll be in touch. And as one of my good friends says, until the next time.
Why don't we come together?
Why don't we come together?
Why do we gotta fight?
Why do we gotta fight?
Let's be like sis and brother who finally got it right. Let's face up each other, black, brown, yellow, white. Let's cherish all the color instead of spitting spite.
Spitting spite.
The highest we can
You are
be.
Listening to the Tom Fitton Show on WNHH LP 103.5 FM, your home for community radio.